Hello and welcome to the Software Stories podcast from Venturi's Voice. I'm your host Liam Donoghue. In this show, I'll be chatting to software experts from all sectors about their careers in tech. The show aims to bring you insights, anecdotes and stories from like-minded professionals that you can learn from and apply to your own careers. If you like the show and you want to hear more from us, you can follow us on SoundCloud, iTunes or Spotify, or you can join our Slack community. Thank you, enjoy the show. Hey there, welcome to another Venturi's Voice podcast. My guest today is Krishan Patel, the CTO at Arkira. Hello Krishan, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm good, how are you?
Yeah, really good. Everything's going great here. I'm really looking forward to chatting to you today. It's really good to have you on. You know, we're going to be talking about everything startup related today, with a special focus on trialing and testing in startups. But before we dive into the show proper, could you tell me and the listeners, you know, a bit about yourself and your career journey? You know, what sort of professional decisions have you made that have brought you to where you are today?
Sure. So I graduated in 2013. I studied computing and I loved it. Whilst I was there, I worked at quite a few big companies as an intern and you know, contracting here and there. And I kind of learned that, you know, I ran into my first hackathon and then startups. And I kind of learned that, you know, I like this very hands-on, very agile way of working, kind of try something, didn't work, try a different one. Failure was not regarded as a bad thing world. And so when I graduated, I did contracting for a bit, but really I was looking for a startup that I could really sink my teeth into, a project that I could really, you know, make some impact on. So I started a company with some friends. We went through one of the accelerators in London. It was called Bethnal Green Ventures. It's still running. It's very good. And they were very helpful. But unfortunately, that didn't work out. Then I did some contracting and made my own apps for a while, worked at a few companies as a contractor. And happened to stumble into Arkira, where I wasn't really looking for like a CTO role. I was just kind of, I was suddenly very interested in making stuff. I was a builder. And so when I first joined here, I was the iOS developer. Like, I kind of didn't even have a formal interview process. The company was 1 week old, and I kind of walked in, and they asked me if I could do some stuff. And I said, well, I don't know, but I can try. And, you know, I've been here ever since.
Amazing. You've broke the mold a bit today with sort of the background you've got. The past few people I've interviewed have all tinkered with the technology, but then went to university and done either economics or business. Mm-hmm. And they said that's been a really good process for them because they've always had interests in tech, but at the time they felt that they couldn't do technology as a degree because it wasn't really a subject available to them then. But you've obviously come in, went straight in and did computer science, was it, or computing?
It's called computing at Imperial, but it's basically the same thing as computer science in most other universities.
But when you said you worked in some big companies, were you working as a technologist in them companies, or were you doing more of a business role?
No, so I worked at Google. I was in the YouTube team. I worked on the YouTube Android Player API, which hasn't got the most shortest name in the world, but it was a way for developers to put YouTube videos directly in their app. And then I worked on a precursor to what is now YouTube Kids. So yes, I was technical the whole way through.
Amazing, yeah. Well, what I'm trying to lead on to here is, you know, where do you think you've managed to pick up maybe some more of the business skills you need, certainly for the CTO? You know, where have they come from? Has that just been through trial and error through your technical roles?
Yeah, I mean, the two CEOs here, so we have co-CEOs who started the company together. They're both very experienced. They both come from a finance world and like 20 plus years each. Very successful, very inspirational guys. They've kind of been there the whole time. So anytime I needed help or anything that I was not sure about, you know, they're always there to help me. And they built an awesome network around us of, you know, professionals that they've known. So having worked in these large financial companies for a long time, they know, you know, very experienced technical people from those companies and around those companies. So whenever I needed help, there is always someone around that can offer guidance.
Amazing. That's the classic sort of finding the people who maybe have the skills that you're not too strong in and then coming together to form a business. So, thanks for sharing all that. Could you also tell us what Arkira does?
Yes.
What space do you occupy and, you know, what's the company's mission and goals for the future?
Yeah, sure. So Arkira is a financial technology company, fintech in London. The website is arkira.ai. What we do is we currently are focused on mining local intelligence from emerging market countries. So let's say Egypt, what is happening in Egypt, like on the ground there? Like what is the local blog post saying, or what is the local press saying to the people of that country? And we expose this to financial professionals working at, you know, hedge funds or big banks or asset managers, and give them a way to easily, we give them two products. One product is a way to easily query this information, so find the information they're looking for via, you know, text that is available on the internet. And secondly, we have a feed that they can tap into that gives them the best insights for the day in those markets.
Mm-hmm. So you, I think I'm going to oversimplify this now, but are you essentially sort of a news aggregator that brings stories to people so they can make better financial decisions?
Yeah. So the difference between what we do and what a news aggregator does is, like, when news aggregators work, their goal is to like aggregate news. Our goal is definitely not aggregate news. If we didn't have to use news at all, we would not. Our goal is to get the information to these traders or salesmen or, you know, any finance professional in a timely manner so they can make use of it in however way they choose. It's not about making different decisions. It's just about having the right information to make those decisions. And the fact that we get it from the news or, you know, social media, or, you know, it's not just news. Some of it's you know, filings and things like that. Is a kind of a means to an end. It is not the goal in itself.
Amazing. Yeah. I mean, the fintech space is exploding at the moment. You know, there's so many different startups and so many different companies doing a lot of different things. I don't want to go too deep into sort of disruption today on the podcast, but it'd be great to get your take on, you know, why is fintech exploding like it is now? You know, why do you think society is just at the stage it is now where people are, you know, wanting to use these small agile fintech companies?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it does lead on nicely to the what I imagine the rest of the conversation would look like. But one of the things I imagine a lot, and, you know, have using a lot of these things, like a lot of the challenger banks and, you know, investing platforms, I do use them when I can, is that they're making things accessible to users in a way that was not done before. Like the big banks, they didn't generally have like product management functions or, you know, user experience functions. But these newer companies put that almost at the top of their list. Like if you look at Monzo, like their app is just, you know, such a pleasure to use, and that was never the case in the past. And it's not just that the app is nice, but the fact that they have product and users at the forefront is I think what makes a big difference in when people are looking for or looking to do something. Like it's not a pastime. It's not a like what website should I go to spend some time on it? I need to do this. But if the experience is nice, it's not going to feel like a burden, whereas, you know, a lot of the times in the past it did.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, speaking from personal experience, being the millennial I am, I've made a hard beeline to Monzo just because of the experience is so much better. Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask you as well is a bit about your role as the CTO at Arkira. Yeah. You know, you've been there for almost 5 years. Were you there when the company founded? So did it exist? Before you started?
Yeah, so technically it existed for about a week or 2 weeks before I started.
Right.
But
you were there from the beginning then.
Yeah. I mean, when it started, when I first joined, we were still setting up like Gmail, and obviously no code had been written, and so on.
Yeah, amazing. So it'd just be really interesting to know how your role has changed over time. You know, as the startup's growing, you must have taken on more and more people. You know, how have your daily tasks changed?
Sure, yeah. So yes, you're totally right. Obviously, it's changed massively. When I started, it was like writing code was 100% of my day, and I loved it. And I still do love it. Nowadays, it's a lot more like people stuff is, I think, the biggest where I spend most of the time. We have other meetings like roadmap planning and you know, sprint planning across the company and things like that. But people is where most of my time is spent. So what is the team kind of struggling with? Where is the team getting stuck? How can I unblock them? How can I put, you know, two people together so they can work better, work on their project, their projects go better, and things like that. Like just managing stuff, moving stuff around me so that everything goes smoothly.
Amazing. Yeah, I would like to get onto a bit about sort of people hiring and culture as well a bit further on in the show. So we'll come back to them points then. But one thing I do like to ask CTOs is, how do you decide what technology to invest in? You know, what considerations do you as a CTO have to take into account when looking at purchasing maybe new tools or platforms? Cool. I imagine there's a constant push and pull between maybe investing in new tech that fulfills business goals, but also wanting to invest in tech that's really exciting and maybe cutting edge. So how do you navigate them issues?
Yes, sure. So it's definitely something that we do. There's two points here. One is I generally have very, I don't know what the right word is, but maybe like polarizing views on engineering. So the whole team kind of follows a very strict practice. But on the other hand, it's that this kind of decision is never made by me. It's more made by the team. So we have a very well-defined process for somebody wants to, like there's a problem to be solved. And somebody will say, oh, well, I think we can use this tool to solve it. And obviously it'll have a cost, like, you know, getting to grips with a new tool, maybe it actually costs money, setting it up will have a cost and so on and so on. And they have to validate that, look, using this for the future, like, yes, it's going to have a high short-term cost, but in the long term, it's going to benefit us in this way, this way, this way. Is exactly what this process is designed for. And so it's very rare that I choose a new technology. I'm not sure I've done it for the last few years. I remember when someone joined us and we were working on, sorry for the technical details, but we were working on like one containerization platform as ECR on ECS on AWS. And he really wanted us to use Kubernetes. And like he made a plan, he wrote it out, like this is what it will give us. This is what features we could use one day, don't have a use for now, but we can, you know, easily imagine how it might be useful. And here's how we can go forward with it. And like, you know, a few of us look at it and a few of us in the engineering team look at it. If it involves business, then we involve the CEOs or whoever else might be needed. But generally it's within the engineering team. And we look at it and say, great, this is worth the effort it will take to set out.
Yeah, no, amazing. It's something I want to pick up on there. You said you make decisions sort of collectively in the engineering mm-hmm. team. So that must be, you must have quite a flat hierarchy then at Akira. Is that correct? You know, do you sort of...
Yes. I mean, it's almost entirely flat. So we have CEOs and then we have like heads of teams and then the team itself. Management-wise, there is a bit, not management, that's the wrong word. Like coordination-wise, there's often different hierarchies that get set up, like either put up and taken down very fast or kind of functional in some way. But for example, sprint planning is not particularly run by me. It's run by one of the guys on the engineering team. And that kind of, you know, it's not a role that someone has been assigned to or appointed to. It is semi-formal, but it's not a like, you are in charge of everyone now, go and do it. It's more of a, oh, cool, you're really good at this. Why don't you do it every week? And so the kind of responsibility, we like to focus on responsibilities more than titles. We're small enough that nobody really needs to have a title in the company. Well, except for like when we have to introduce ourselves to other people. Within engineers, like everyone's a software engineer. But the responsibilities people have is definitely not flat. You know, some people are very good at taking on responsibility and maintaining it. And some people are good at finding opportunities for new areas of responsibility. So like a new process, like I can give you an example of something that we introduced not recently, but in the last year was we used to struggle to solve bugs. Like everyone has bugs and like we don't have that many, but we don't like having any, like we want zero. And I used to constantly get frustrated that like, why is no one solving bugs? Why is no one solving bugs? And then one of the engineers came to me and said like, you know, why don't we just have a session where we all sit in a room together and solve the bugs together? Like if we put an hour aside by the end of the year, I'm sure all the bugs would be gone. And it was like, well, great. Like what a perfect solution to the problem. And now he's in charge of that. And every week he leads a session where we have, you know, all the bugs being solved that we can. And, you know, we're very close to zero now. And once we get there, like, I'm not sure what we do with this session, but, you know, it would have been a great achievement.
We actually have a similar practice on our marketing team. We call it like our marketing hackathon. Obviously, we're not writing code, but we have a board where we have all of our big problems that we normally just can't get around to doing, and we commit an hour a week as a team to get into a room and just sort that problem out. Sometimes they take an hour, sometimes they take half a day, but yeah, it's great just to be like, you know, otherwise you'll put it off and put it off because the task of sorting all the bugs seems insurmountable. But when you actually just dedicate an hour, come hook or crook, to do it, then you can get rid of it. This actually brings me on really nicely to what I wanted to ask you next. So obviously we wanted to talk a bit about trialing and testing in a startup. I imagine as a quick moving startup, you need to find out what works for your business fast. So are you an advocate of agile methodologies? You know, do you work with agile principles in your testing process? And, you know, what does that look like?
Great. Yes, I'm sure this will come up. And this is like the only one that I actually have a very formed answer for, which is, yes, I do believe in agile. And when we started the company, we started very much following, I don't know where we read it, maybe some blog online, or maybe there's some official version of this that I can't remember at all. But we started with sprints. We used to have two week long sprints, and we did the retrospective, and we did the number planning, like how many story points each task is, and we did everything very, very by the book. But we quickly found out, although when I say quickly, it was like a year later, like a year of pain later, like nobody really enjoyed this process. It was not really working for anyone, and actually we couldn't measure the benefits of it almost at all, like because we had tried nothing else. We didn't know whether this was the right answer or not. We had just read it online and done it. And so from that point, what we've done, and that was at the point where the kind of the team started forming a lot better in the company. So before, we just had like one big team, and everyone, like data scientists, engineers, kind of sales, everyone's the content guys, we'd all sit in the same room and kind of work together. And this was the point at which the team started forming into their own divisions. So when engineering kind of split off, we, you know, went back to the drawing board, and I think we've been at the drawing board almost ever since. So we do agile, we do sprints, we do retrospectives, but I'm fairly sure there is no company in the world that does it how we do it, because we've designed everything almost from scratch. We went back to, and it's a phrase I always repeat and have, you know, become kind of famous in the company for repeating this phrase, which is like, what is the problem, right? Like, we go back to the thing, what is the problem? The retrospective is there to solve, like, what could we take forward, like keep doing this practice that we did this week and found it worked well. And what should we not take forward? What did we do and that went badly? Or, you know, we tried but did not have the effects we wanted to have. And we structure it like that. Like, we structure it to answer the questions that we should be asking rather than just, oh, let's sit down and do a retrospective, which I think has been very good. So, yeah, we do agile, but it doesn't look like most other companies' version of it.
No, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of agile practitioners, some people who, you know, are working in digital agencies and they're taking agile methodologies to clients. But I think I can only speak from the people I've spoke to because we don't really do agile in the same way. But I think you'd actually find quite a lot of companies take sections of it they like and they'll drop sections they don't. And I think it can be very easy for businesses to think, that's it, we are agile now and we have to use all of this framework. And I don't think you do at all. I think you can just pick and choose what works for you, and as long as it's efficient and trackable, then it's fine. But no, it's just really great that you highlighted that point, because yeah, it's something that we hear a lot, which, you know, agile isn't a one size fits all, and it can be used in totally different ways.
I think the key of like constantly asking yourself of, we used to have one engineer who isn't with us anymore, but he always used to ask, he always used to say that he hated the idea of processes. Any process, he would be immediately have a negative reaction to it. And one day, like, we sat down and we were talking about, like, why do you have a negative reaction to processes? And he was like, he couldn't say immediately, but we eventually got to the bottom of it, which is often people have processes that they do, but forget why they're doing them. And for us, this is the key. Like, we constantly have to remind ourselves, like, why are we doing this? Like, if it's a year down the line and we haven't updated a process, we should look back and say, like, are we still doing this for the same reason? Do we still have the same problem that we had a year ago in the same form, or should we be looking to update it?
I think that brings me on really nicely to my next point I wanted to ask you about as well, which is very much the other side of the coin than what we've just been talking about. But do you think there's ever a danger of not committing to a course of action due to too much testing or iterations? You know, can you spend so long trialing and testing different things that you end up becoming paralyzed with indecision. You know, how do you avoid that?
Yes, totally. When we do testing and trial, so we actually don't use these words in the company much, like testing and trialing. And the way we think about it is, I'll give you an example. So in the last sprint planning, one of the things we decided was the retrospective at the end of the week. We realized that everyone sitting down at the end of the week was a bit of a struggle for them to then think about, like, what have I done well in the week, or what did somebody else especially do that was good in the week? Imagine you have we do it on Tuesdays, but imagine you have a really bad Monday. It's going to be very hard to remember anything good that happened on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday or the week before. So this week we decided that there's a new process, which is whoever's creating the document for retrospective, create it straight away after the sprint planning. And for everyone else, during the week, write it in as you go along. So don't wait until the end of the week to think about it. Mm-hmm. Write it in as you go along. And it's not we didn't say like, oh, let's try this for the week and see how it goes. It's literally we're starting this now. Do it. But then with the knowledge, like everyone knows that next week we will look back at this process itself and say, did it work or not work? And should we carry it on, or should we change it in some way? So it's not a let's try something for a week and see how it goes. It's a let's do it. Mm-hmm. And we will keep iterating as we go along. I think the difference is the knowledge that almost any decision we make, even with your previous question of the technologies we use, with any decision we make, I think everyone in the engineering team is constantly aware that these decisions are not permanent. Like they are, you take them, you live by them. But then if you find a better way or a different problem that is not solved by this, but should be, we will reevaluate. We will come back and look at it and think, how can we solve, you know, a bigger problem here?
Great. Yeah. Really interesting. And that again brings me on very nicely to the next point I wanted to ask you about, which was managing failure. You know, obviously iterating a lot must lead to a fair amount of failure. And obviously we're not talking about like, you know, the naughty step at school sort of failure. We're talking about obviously, you know, a process hasn't worked, you know. So how do you as a CTO remove the, you know, the stigma attached to failure and turn it into something that employees don't need to be worried about?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. And I definitely don't think we've solved this. I mean, I think like one of the, an easy example of this is if someone is given a task and they cannot do it, like, will they say immediately like, oh, this was too hard, I didn't manage to do it, can someone help me? Or will they struggle with it for a bit too long until it gets like almost painful, and then someone has to go over and say like, what's going on? And say, oh, well, I just did not manage to do it. And like sometimes the first one happens, but very often it's still the second one. Mm-hmm. But it's not, one of the big things that we have is we don't really attribute anything as failure. Like we never say, oh, you failed. It's very rare that happens. It's usually an iteration that did not go in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And so we just iterate again. Mm-hmm. Like, if everything is seen as iteratable, then it's very rare that you look back at something and say, oh, this whole thing failed, because that it almost never happens. Because if you're constantly changing, then like, unless you were blind the whole time, you would have been changing very reactively to like what is working and what isn't working. Mm-hmm. Of course, the difficulty there is like, often you might iterate into a place where you think you are doing something good. But, you know, if you had done it, if you had looked at it more holistically, made, you know, like, sat down for a week and made a big plan rather than do something for a week, you might have ended up in a different place that could have been better. But given the amount of time that takes and given how fast we need to move, like everyone actually has work, like code to write. We very rarely like have to think about that decision negatively.
Yeah.
It usually works out for us.
Yeah. No, I think, yeah, just from my point of view as well, I think there's still some work to be done in sort of breaking down that stigma of failure, you know, sort of from the idea of like the 1970s skyscraper, big corporate, everyone's in suits and you've got your manager breathing down your neck if you do something wrong. That, you know, that sort of like win or die mentality that comes along, well, used to come along with business, is getting chipped away at now through like, you know, the processes you just spoke about.
Totally, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of processes that we have in place. Like thinking back, the way you answered it made me think of some more stuff. Like, which is, we as soon as someone joins, whenever someone is onboarded, like one of the first and continual things they will always hear is ask more questions. Like, the goal is not to be right. The goal is for no individual to be right. The goal is for the team to make the right decision together and be in a better place like next week than we are today. But if no one's asking questions, if everyone's just working on their own quietly in their corner, no one's growing, like no one's learning anything. Like you're not, you know, if you're right, then great, you are right, but you don't you gain nothing. If you were wrong and you learn and you ask a question, you learn something, like you win. Like there, wrong there is not actually a bad thing, it's a good thing, right? Like you gain something from that thing. And so what we try and do with pair programming and stuff, we try and set it up so that failure is not really an option. Like it's not, it doesn't really come about because the path people are on, they ask questions, like iterate. Like you it's very rare that you end up in a place where, oh well, nothing works.
Yeah. And I suppose if you do get to the point where somebody hasn't raised their hand, then there's probably another reason there that they feel like they can't, and you can sort that out. Exactly. And it's great. I think you've brought me on really nicely to the next thing I wanted to talk about as well. You know, in the last third of the show, we always like to talk about hiring and culture as well. So when you as a CTO were looking for new hires, do you tend to aim for people who would be a good culture fit for your company or a great technical fit? And why do you hire based on them?
Yeah, interesting. So this, given like if you had asked me like a few years ago, it would have definitely been a totally different answer. When we first started, I was very much of the mind that like, everyone has to be technically awesome. And we kind of focused a lot on technical ability. It didn't necessarily work out for us. It's very hard to measure technical ability in the current like interview processes that people do. Like, you know, like people talk about Google's whiteboarding, and which I think they've gotten rid of now, but people talk about Google's whiteboarding and, you know, sending coding challenges and stuff. But this is all very, very difficult to actually measure a person's technical aptitude over the course of like 3 years in, you know, 30 minutes or 3 hours. But yes, when we first started, we were hiring mostly on technical ability. But now it is mostly culture fit. So the culture we have in the engineering team is one of, you know, asking questions and learning. And that is the biggest thing we look for. It's not how much do you know, it's how much are you going to know, how much are you going to learn, how much are you going to contribute back to everybody else. For example, this week we have a guy who made his first pull request in Python, like the language Python. And so that it's such an awesome process because now everyone will look at that and think, oh, well, I can do that too. You know, so like that, it's not, and it may not be the best code in the world. It may not be the best idea in the world, but he contributed to the language that we all use day to day without even looking at it. Having that kind of culture of like trying stuff, doing things, learning, asking is what we look for. And that for us, we found works way better than when we used to look for technical ability. Because when we had people that were technically great, but not necessarily team or kind of together players, we would struggle in times when we needed to work together. So we'd be very good in times where we had a very simple task. Someone would come and say, make this, and everyone would run off in their own direction and make something, and then we put it back together. And because everyone was technically good, it would work very well. But if there was a problem that nobody individually knew how to solve, so like, let's say everything goes down one day. This didn't happen, but for example, everything goes down one day. You have to come together as a team and be able to solve it. You need to be able to say, okay, I'm going to go this, you do this, you do this, you do this. We'll come back. We'll learn from each other, figure out what's going on and make a new plan from there. It can't just be four people looking independently for a solution because that is very unlikely that would work.
Yeah, I mean, I think that loops back really nicely to the whole idea of iterative, fast-moving things. You don't want of somebody coming into your business, which is sort of like the end product, and they, you know, I code in JavaScript, I code in C#, and that's all I do. You want somebody who will keep learning and adapting in the same way that your company is constantly learning and adapting and iterating to new problems.
Yeah, I mean, it's picking up language is a perfect example. So when we were hiring 6 months ago or a year ago, when we hired people, we hired them specifically for, like, you guys are doing front end, you guys are doing back end, so you guys are doing JavaScript and you guys are doing Python. And then about 6 months ago, we changed the entire company, the entire engineering team, to be one big team. Everyone's doing everything. And given like the kind of people we were hiring, everyone has adapted wonderfully. Now everyone can do Python, everyone can do JavaScript, and nobody complains. Like, in fact, everyone loves it. Everyone loved that they got the opportunity to learn a whole new thing. Like, they started from zero. Everyone else around them, like, they all learned together. It worked out very well. And then, you know, when we had a project where we needed everyone on JavaScript for 2 weeks, it worked out great for the company. Like, the company immediately saw the benefits of that decision. I think it works out for everyone in that way, like not just engineering, but business too.
Amazing. Yeah, I suppose that's a great way to maximize the amount of, what's the word I'm looking for?
Flexibility that, like, if we need everyone to work on some API problem, great, everyone can do it. If we need everyone to work on some JavaScript problem, great, everyone can do it. It's not a We only have two of those. You should have told me earlier, we could have hired more engineers.
Productivity, that's it. It's a great way to maximize the productivity of a small team, yeah. So I suppose the last big question from me is, you know, what role does your company culture play in sort of creating a, you know, fail fast, iterative workspace? You know, do you spend a lot of time like making sure that you've got a great working environment, and does that help when you are, you know, you're trying to fail fast and work on projects?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the things that when we started the company, it wasn't very obvious that we were thinking about this at all. In fact, we did not spend that much time thinking about this compared to like thinking about technical problems. But now this is probably one of the biggest things we think about. So how do we make everyone feel comfortable with, you know, suggesting new things, like bringing up ideas, solving problems? I think one of the biggest problems we have generally in tech, not us, but technical people in general, is like, it's very easy to come up with a solution. Everyone can find ways to solve things. But like identifying the right problem is a very difficult skill, I think. And so the way we do this is whenever we're speaking to people, like in the all hands, for example, whenever we're in meetings, we try and keep this in mind. Especially with an engineer, but throughout the company. And so it inspires people to, like, you know, you have an idea. If someone, we don't generally like just shoot down an idea, but if someone has an idea and it's like, I think we can solve it with this, like, great, add it to the list and we'll think about them more. And if it doesn't get included, like, it's fine. Like, no, great, have another idea. Like, keep trying, shoot them all out. Let's see where it goes. Not a, oh, that guy had the best idea last time, he must have the best idea this time, because that just doesn't work long term.
No, amazing. Yeah, some really great takeaways from the podcast today. I've really enjoyed myself. It's always really fun. I personally really like chatting about agile methodologies, so it's always great when I get to chat about working in agile with people. So no, it's been a really fun show for me today. Just a quick one more. You know, if anyone is interested in maybe looking at Akira for, you know, to use your products, or if anyone's interested in applying for roles with you, where can they find you?
For roles or even reaching out for anything, I'm on Twitter. Lots of the team are on Twitter, and we have an official company Twitter too. I'm on Twitter at Christian711, so my first name, 711. That would be the best place to reach me. It's very easy. If it's like a client thing, then great. The website is the best place to go, and there's a support link there. Like, one of the CEOs, the CEO that manages that, he's awake pretty much all the time. Like, he will respond almost immediately if someone emails there.
Yeah. Amazing. No, thanks for sharing. Again, I've had a really, really fun chat today. It's been really enjoyable. So hopefully we can catch up again soon. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yes, thank you very much.
Ace, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this Venturi's Voice podcast. You can find links to any resources mentioned in the episode in the show notes on our website. If you enjoyed the show and want to hear more, you can find us on SoundCloud, iTunes and Spotify. We also have a Slack community, which you can join via the link on our homepage at venturi-group.com. Thanks for tuning in. I look forward to seeing you again.